What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Daniel Prince, author of Choose Life, The Tools, Tricks, and Hacks of Long-Term Family Travelers, World Schoolers, and Digital Nomads, featured in Forbes magazine, the host of Once Bitten podcast, an excellent Bitcoin podcast, and definitely check out the Prince's Off the Grid blog, princesoffthegrid.weebly.com. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Daniel. How are you?
Great to be here. Thank you for the great introduction.
Awesome. It's really great to be here, to be chatting with you. I really want to get into this book that you wrote. It's really had an impact on me. I love it. I marked it up. I'd love to hear just more about the backstory and some of the decisions and things you went through to get to where you are now. You ended up, I think, in Singapore at a very young age, working and starting your career. But then, obviously, we get to the point where you really choose life. And you kind of move on from that lifestyle, and I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you can see, I have Lauren here with me, who co-hosts the Once Bitten podcast.
Awesome.
She's usually asking the first question.
Sure.
So I thought perhaps she would come and receive the first question.
Yeah. That sounds great. So I'm wondering, you know, how did you like world schooling? And you know, what was it like to be away from your friends and making new friends?
Well, since I was world schooling a lot, I didn't really have that much friends. But when I made new friends, it felt good because then I had more and more. And in the future, I still have more to come.
That's right. Well, you were just 3 years old when we started traveling, weren't you? So you... do you even remember those days, those early days? Through pictures, I suppose, because we look at the pictures a lot and talk about the stories.
Yeah, sometimes it gets me memories.
Yeah, my daughter's 4, and so she's a little younger than you now, but maybe a year older than when you left. So it's something we're thinking about, maybe not global world schooling, but definitely maybe on the road schooling. I definitely wanted to get your feedback. That was really great. Do you have anything else advice you would give my daughter? Or my 8-year-old son?
Don't talk a lot about Bitcoin in front of them. They might get fed up of you.
Fair enough. That's fair. I'll definitely take that to heart. I definitely want them to learn about Bitcoin, but I don't want them to be bored and to hate it. So I will take that to heart. That's good advice. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking the first question. Do you want to say goodnight?
Yeah. And bye.
It was so nice to meet you.
It was really nice to meet you too.
Take care.
Have a good podcast.
Thank you so much. That was awesome, Daniel. I appreciate that. I got the Once Bitten treatment. I liked it. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really, really good. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's I was listening to some of your shows earlier. Looks like you've gone straight ahead and dived straight into this.
Yeah,
this is amazing.
I'm definitely going full speed ahead and really trying to put everything into it. I've been inspired by you. To be honest, I came across your podcast while doing research for mine. And kind of starting my podcast and looking for, you know, to kind of hear my guests that I was going to have in different places broadened my horizons. And I love listening to different Bitcoin podcasts. I think there's a lot of space for different voices. I think the space will grow. I loved hearing your voice and I loved seeing the success of your show. And it was really inspirational. And then I got to learn a little bit about you. I was like, how did he start this show? How did you become a Bitcoin podcaster? So maybe we'll start there.
Yeah, sure. If you want to dive into that, or do you want to dive into your original question, which is about the book? How do you want to steer it?
Well, let's get into the book first, because that's definitely, okay, you know, the reason I the primary reason I had you on the show.
Right, sure. So the quick backstory to that, then, I guess that starts back in the mid 90s when I came out of college. We call it in the UK like sixth form. I didn't go to university. I went straight to work in the city. So I grew up in the southeast of England, and I followed my father's footsteps into the world of, you know, finance. He was working in the city for many years on the banking side, as many families do in that part of the world. You know, the home counties, they make their way to London to start their careers. So I started in a foreign exchange brokerage firm at a very low level, the lowest level you can get, to the point where you are just getting the breakfast and getting the coffees and taking the guys dry cleaning down and getting their shoes cleaned for them and getting money out of the bank and parking their cars and getting their breakfast, getting their lunch, getting their snacks, getting their lottery tickets, getting their everything. It was just gopher, total gopher. And this was around 2 or 3 years that, you know, you have to endure that. I finally got my chance to take my career to Asia, to Singapore, where I could actually start building something worthwhile within that industry and servicing clients and, you know, a customer facing role, and foreign exchange being the quickest, fastest moving and biggest market in the world, was a great place to cut your teeth, and really enjoyed it. And we lived in Singapore for 15 years whilst I built out that career there. And we had 4 kids, all born in Singapore. And it got to a point where just it wasn't clicking anymore. I wasn't what generally happens to most guys. There's either some kind of terrible burnout or midlife crisis. And I never wanted to actually face one of those down. And I just started falling out of love a little bit with the industry. And then an opportune moment, a friend told me I should check out the book, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And I read it and I got to the last page and I flipped it over and I read it again. And then I read it again and I was bugging the hell out of my wife. I think I was like reading her full chapter sometimes. You know how we are now as Bitcoiners, where you grab onto something and you just got to share that knowledge with someone. And I was doing this with this book, and ultimately it led to, I read that book and I picked it up in November 2013, and by March 2014, we'd sold everything. I'd quit my career. We'd taken the kids out of school and we were gone. We were like, let's go explore the world with the kids. Let's do something different. There were some other influences in that time when we were doing all of this real deep research into what does this really mean? You know, what are the implications? Can we even do this? Are there other people doing it? What does this mean for education? And that's when we found the Sir Ken Robinson TED Talk, Do Schools Kill Creativity? And that gets you thinking. You know, you go down that rabbit hole, the education system rabbit hole, and you ultimately find that there's a lot wrong with it, and there's a lot engineered in certain ways, and ultimately came to the decision, well, if we're gonna do something different, let's go travel and let's see how long we can make it last and give the kids an experiential learning experience rather than, you know, sit down in rows of tables and just be force-fed information.
Right.
And we did find a lot of families that had done it. And this is back in 2014. You could find blogs of families that have done this in many different ways. And so you just reach out and you find people get straight back to you with tips and tricks. And this is how we did it. And this is why we did it. And you find yourself immediately aligned with people who you've never met before in many different ways. And you just learn from them. And then you just go out and, you know, you follow the path that they've slightly beaten for you and you make your own way. And like anything, once you've finally decided to do something, once you actually start doing it, you're like, huh, wow.
Right.
All those fears, all those worries, you know, that very few of them are ever realized.
Yeah. You know, but I wonder, like, I really want to go back to Singapore, though. Because it seems like you kind of already went through an experience like that. I've transferred a lot with work, like from New York to San Francisco. I never had the intention of staying maybe forever in San Francisco. And here, you know, you went to Singapore at a really young age and settled there, which is, I think, a very almost world schooling or not nomad experience, but an expat experience. And how much did that maybe, you know, drive your thinking or you know, you were already, and I'm wondering how that affected your family already, like your the extended family, the grandparents and the cousins being so far away from maybe the UK.
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, yeah, I was young. We were both young. I was still 22. My wife, I think, had just turned 23. I was about to turn 23 when we turned up there in Singapore. And we weren't married at that point. So yeah, that was a huge, we turned up with a suitcase each.
Right.
That was it. Because at that point I was still living with my parents and she was still living with her parents. We'd never lived together. Mm. And then all of a sudden we're on a plane halfway across the world and you know, you have this two bedroom apartment in a condominium and you're like, whoa, this is amazing. And you have an actual shot at building a career. Whereas in London, people there just very, very protective. You've got no chance of really progressing as quickly as you would like. But what it did do immediately is open all of your senses, to be perfectly mm-hmm. honest. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd moved from a town that we'd both grown up in to across the other side of the world, and you're meeting new people every single day from different countries, a myriad of different countries, and your mind just expands. It's just you get this like almost immediate worldview, and it was unbelievable experience. The very very first 2 or 3 months is just like you're on this roller coaster. So that would have definitely started shaping our worldview and much more open to everything, languages, cultures, differences that you know, you'd grown up, these narratives that you get fed as you're growing up as kids, that all started to melt away, which was very formative.
Do you think like being in Singapore made getting through the grind like more fun or more enriching, and maybe helped you stay in that seat longer because you weren't just at home? You kind of were exploring just by being in Singapore.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to work with a bunch of guys that I just really loved working with. You know, we used to love going into work for 6 years. Us as a team, we worked really, really well together, and we had fun in the office, and it worked. We were managing to make money and to save, and it was brilliant. I really, really enjoyed it, and that, you know, I always look back fondly on those days.
Right. And now you're still, I guess, you're not in the UK anymore, or you're not, you chose to maybe spend some more time, but more stabilized somewhere else. Something else that really came through to me in the book was just that you had to place a lot of trust and faith in humanity, and you had to kind of develop and grow that trust and faith. And there's a lot of experiences that you talk about in the book. And I'm wondering how much of that was developed by, you know, this experience of living in Singapore and having to trust this new system, a new country. I know it's a melting pot. You're meeting all these great people. But you're deciding to have like raise your family there, use the school system there or homeschool there. I'm not sure the specifics there. You're going to have your kids born there. Everyone has to visit to see you. And then so I'm wondering, you know, as you move into like Bitcoin, we talk a lot about like don't trust, verify. And so it's like a yin and a yang. Because in the meat space, you really have to trust people, I guess. You know, you're going to go into a hospital. You got to work with a doctor. How much do you think your trust in humanity has grown and is maybe more like mature than other people?
Yes. So I found actually, when we first got out there, then, you're just meeting. So, like I said, you're meeting so many people and you're making like friendships in the snap of a finger because everybody's in the same boat. You know, you're expatriates, you're American, you're Australian, you're a Kiwi, I'm a Brit, there's a South African guy over here and there's a German guy over here and we're all working in the same business and we're all drinking in the same pubs, and you just click immediately. And that was really amazing to have that experience. I would say that started to wear off just as the grind of daily life. You know, once you've been in the same place for 15 years, you know how it just becomes routine, right? And you've probably got a solid network by then, and you start hanging out with the same people. And I would say the biggest, when I left, when we left, I'd got to the point where I was pretty unsociable, because I was doing what I needed to do during the day, mm-hmm. and getting home to the wife and the kids of the evening. The other two, three nights a week, the other two nights a week, I'd probably be entertaining or being dragged around to client corporate functions or whatever. Right. So that kind of just drags you down when you're just on that grind. You're on the proverbial hamster wheel. Yeah. And you get over that and you start closing down to meeting more people and getting into kind of non-versations, as I like to call them. You know, my wife would go, I met a lady in the playground and she's got a couple of kids, and I'm like, please, no more. Like, I can't meet any more just random people, because it's just that there's always so much going on. I'm just exhausted come the weekends. So yeah, I was definitely a bit of a grump by the end of it. And that U-turned within 1 or 2 months after we left and we started traveling. And I guess you find yourself again. And my wife was shocked. She's like, what the, you talk to people now? Mm-hmm. Like you actively look out, draw people out and have conversations with them. And it was pretty, it was an eye-opening experience. But what really changed it is when we started the home swapping, when we got into the sharing economy. That's what unlocked our ability to travel for a really long term.
Right.
Because otherwise we were probably going to make it 6 to 9 months, then run out of cash and go running back to a job somewhere. We had a property in Thailand, which we'd invested in 15 years ago when we were living in Singapore, because obviously the currency at that point was very favorable and you could buy a property. So that's where we listed that home on a swapping site rather than a renting site. And I was blown away by that community, this community of home swappers that welcome people from all over the world, wherever they are, and exchange their homes with each other. And that was like, I had no idea this kind of level of trust existed between human beings.
Right.
And it's a very niche group, because many people listening are probably thinking, I'd never let anyone random just come and stay in my house.
That you know, I want to get to that in a second, but you brought up you finding yourself when you leave the job or the golden handcuffs, and I know what you mean. I when I was 25, I left my big four accounting job and I went on a 3-month backpacking trip through the South Pacific, and you know, you bring up like identity, and a lot of times you find identity through your work, and it was weird. People would say, "What do you do?" You know, or tell us about yourself. And I was in between. You know, I just left my career and I was 3 months away from film school, and it was a weird moment in identity. And how do you identify yourself other than just your name and what you like? What was that experience like for you to kind of almost grow a new shell, or you know, whatever it is, take off the mask and find yourself?
Difficult.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult. You don't realize how much of that identity hangs around your neck. Or as I say in the I think there's a quote in the book about wearing a mask. That was, you know, maybe the first 2 or 3 weeks, it just feels like you're on holiday. But after that, your monkey mind starts kicking in. It's like, what the hell have you done? You know, where is this going to lead? And you start getting all of these self-doubts. You're not a you're not contributing to society in any way. And what are you? Like, what are you? You can't now tell people, I'm a foreign exchange broker. You've, in many people's eyes, you're just an unemployed bum, mm-hmm. an irresponsible parent who's taken, you know, four kids out of school and out of the country that they've been brought up in and dragging them around the world. On whose whim is this? You know, is this just you trying to, is this your midlife crisis sort of thing? So to not have the identity affected, it affected me a great deal. It's very difficult to face. And of course, it affected my wife as well, because now all of a sudden she's left a country that she's known for 15 years, really solid friends, really solid network, respected within her friend group, you know, mother of four kids, knows how Singapore works. A lot of people would come to her for advice, and expat mum, and now nothing. Like, you know, we were both in it together. We were both nothing. And it was weird. And it's really weird. Freeing as well. But at the same time, we're our own worst enemies, right? It's the monkeys in our mind that are causing the biggest problems.
Yeah, you talk a lot about the monkey mind in your book, and how do you deal with the monkey mind? You kind of have a lot of ideas about it. Like, how does one tame the monkey in their mind and kind of get through that?
Yeah, that's what led me down the path of the Headspace app and finding Andy Puddicum. And I would try and, you know, make a habit of doing that. And then Naval Ravikant, I love listening to his thoughts and wisdom.
Yeah.
And I think he said in an interview on a podcast, I can't remember exactly which one, but something along the lines of, once you realize that it's just a monkey running around in your head, going crazy and like throwing feces up the wall, and if you can just for no reason, if you can sit still and kind of picture that monkey and just watch it go crazy and until it just sits down again and moves on, it was just like a glib comment that just really kind of struck home with me. It's like, shit, yeah. And if that's happening in his head, that's happening in everybody's head,
right.
And it's just, we're so conditioned to like run 1,000 miles an hour. To think about this, like, you know, why is it so hard to convince someone that they just need to sit down and do nothing for 10 minutes?
I mean, it is. I think a lot of it's the externalities in our world. Another way a sage told me to look at, like, kind of the monkey mind is, like, just imagine your thoughts going by, like, on a boat in a river. And they're just your thoughts, and you can watch them go by. You don't have to give them any power. You don't have to give them any attention. But you could pick them up maybe off the boat and look at them and maybe put them back or whatever. But just know that they're thoughts, and you don't have to give power to that narrative. One thing I'm kind of thinking is, I think about your experiences as a very low time preference. You know, I think a lot of people might think it was, like you were saying at first glance, like high time preference. Like, oh, he's out on a midlife crisis. He's on a holiday. He's living it up now. But, you know, you're giving your family a lot of togetherness time, and you're all present. And I think there's a lot to be gained from that. So, my kind of question with that is, like, would you recommend, like, you had good investments or assets to kind of build on, maybe to trade when you entered this kind of, like, period of your life. Like, what about someone maybe selling their Bitcoin savings to finance this kind of experience or start it up? Would that make sense to you? You know, or is it like, do whatever you can to hold your Bitcoin and never, you know, find another way to save fiat or anything else? Do you have any thoughts on that now that we're in a Bitcoin world?
Yeah. Ooh. Those sats, man. Parting with those sats, right? That's the thing. It's so different for everybody, and everybody's in a completely different situation, and life ebbs and flows completely differently. You know, it's hard to say one one thing for anyone. But at the end, you know, if Bitcoin teaches us anything, it's to be more self-sovereign with our own decisions and our own thoughts. And if I think about looking back when we were making this decision, Bitcoin hadn't found me at that point. We were putting a lot of thought into it, a lot of sleepless nights. It's tough. Should someone the upside to doing something for your family that is going to create such a unique bond, that's got to trump any kind of, you know, fiscal worry at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's what kind of really got across in your book to me as well. Like, you kind of listed maybe the pros and cons, or kind of like, what can happen? What's the worst thing that can happen if I give up my job and we don't get this traveling ship off the ground? We run out of money. And you were like, you know, I mean, the worst that's going to happen, I'm going to move home with my folks. We're going to be with people that love us. We're going to be fed. We're going to watch Netflix. And I'll dig into my network. I'll put out some calls. And then you even touched on just even leaving your job, I think, created opportunities for you that was, you know, that almost, you know, creates a desire to pull you back in.
It does. Yeah, it's like, you know, one door, people say, well, one door closes, another one opens. I would argue one door closes, you step back and look down the corridor and every other single door is opened. It's, you know, as soon as you walk away from something that you've been, chained to, then... As long as you can breathe and take a second and not panic. I remember that part of the book now. It was like the fear setting exercise, right? Instead of setting goals, set your fears and write your fears down, which, it's harder than writing down your goals, I suppose. In goals, you can get all dreamy. If you write down your actual fears, you've got to be very honest with yourself. My biggest fear is going bankrupt and living under a bridge,
right?
Which, you know, it's ridiculous, really, on the face of it, because when you do go through that exercise, well, what would actually have to happen for you to, you know, really go bankrupt? You know, that'd be a catastrophic set of events. And like you said, you know, you come to the conclusion, well, hang on a minute, I've got extended family. My wife has extended family. Or, you know, there's places for us to go, and you can get back on your feet. That when you start listing the fears, and then listing out the steps you would take to overcome those fears, if they were ever to pass, you can rationally think your way through that problem, and all the barriers just start melting away.
Right. One of the other notions that was really interesting was, how do you manage maybe your productivity now, but maybe, you know, you wake up, you feel like you're 3 months into this holiday, you're no longer tied to the desk, you're not, you know, cranking out deliverables 9 to 5 or 8 to 8 or whatever it is, you're not going to the meetings. How do you, like, balance productivity, maybe feel that you're being productive?
You would have those days that you just those self-doubts would start creeping in if you're lazy and not contributing to society. They are pretty tough. What I would do is a reverse to-do list, I think I call it. So if you're having one of those times, I would break out a notebook and just start writing down the things I'd achieved that day. I tried to make this a nightly habit when I was, you know, really having a tough time with the kind of self-doubt and whatever else. And you realize after about a minute, you've got a list as long as your arm of the stuff that you've been doing. And that could be as basic as, you know, making breakfast for the kids, helping them do this, going and fetching some shopping, you know, preparing lunch, replying to 10 emails, calling your mom, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Just because you've not been meeting KPIs set by some maniacal boss, that's what's in the back of your mind. But when you actually sit down and see what you've achieved throughout the day, it's pretty mind-blowing the amount of tasks that a human being gets through in one day.
Yeah. I thought it was a really interesting anecdote when you mentioned that you told, I think, your boss you were having twins, and he was pretty pumped because that meant the chains were getting heavier. I'm also wondering, you know, what do you think, how do you think COVID like impacts world traveling now and world schooling or being a global nomad?
Yeah, when this thing came around, I was really bullish on the fact that schools were going to close and families were going to get a free look at homeschooling and what it could mean for them and what it could mean for their families. And I was very bullish on the fact, well, this is clearly going to speed up remote work. And this gives people a very close look at the fact that they don't have to drag their asses into an office and work, you know, 9 to 5. You know, no one ever does that anyway, like 8 to 8, whatever it is they're doing. And the remote work side of it, that's great. People have now got a taste of that and they understand, and many, many bosses and many companies, they're going to change their tune and give opportunities to employees you don't have to be chained now to the sphere of influence around the city that you're working. You can go and live in nicer, greener areas. For the schooling though, what happened was just school at home. It wasn't homeschooling. And homeschooling is a different mindset. It's not this, many people, they think that, oh, homeschooling is just the parents, you know, doing math at 9 o'clock, and then there's a break at 9:45, then they'll pick up at 10 and do history, then they'll break again for a bit of lunch, and then they'll pick up and they'll do science in the afternoon, and they'll follow these textbooks, and we've got a chalkboard in the front room. That's not homeschooling. Homeschooling is a completely different mindset, and there's a lot of unschooling and deschooling that needs to go in to prepare people for making this shift. And what was happening throughout COVID with regards to schooling was just emails were getting sent out to parents of worksheets that they're printing out to sit their kids down at the breakfast table and try and power through it. And it was causing a lot of angst because nobody was used to this situation, and the kids, they're always going to push back against their parents, and the parents are feeling the fear that we get shoved down our necks, like, oh, you know, they should be up to speed, they should be reading at this level, they should know how to do their times tables by now, and they should be able to do this, and, like, you know, this measuring technique that we've got across these poor kids, which is disgusting, really. You know, we all know, we're all adult to realize we learn at different speeds and in different ways. Why we think we can sit 30 kids in a room together and they should all be at the same reading level and writing level and math level is just ludicrous. But we have these experts in air quotes telling us this is how the best way to educate. It's beyond belief, actually. And so that was what was happening. It was causing a lot of grief within families, which is a real shame, because I think it's pushed back. Even here in France, we have President Macron is trying to ban homeschooling as of 2021. It's just an absolutely nonsensical reason, and it's just there are a lot of bad implications behind the whole thing. So I hope for anybody listening that when they did have their families at home and their kids at home, and they were doing some kind of reading, writing, and were seeing a difference in their child's personality or a difference in their child's natural bent, you know, what was really interesting them. If you know that these flames, they get snuffed out in the education system. If school is almost 100% strike rate, it gets 100% strike rate almost of killing the love of learning. I think we all leave school just like, get me to work. I'm done now. I don't ever want to look at another textbook, and which is a real shame. And then when we all fall down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin, for example, you know, stop us. Try stopping us. I want to learn everything and anything as much as possible about this whole thing. But you sit someone down in a classroom to do it and force them to do it. It doesn't work. I've ranted there, so I can't remember your original question.
No, that was great. I'm wondering what advice do you have for someone who wants to unschool their kids or deschool their kids, and they're starting right now, you know, maybe in a week, or, you know, this is on the top of their mind. What do they do?
You got to deschool yourself first.
Okay.
It's got to start with you.
What is that?
It has to start with you. You got to deschool, man. You've got to deschool. Like we've all been there. We've been like, we have so much emotional baggage from that system, however many years we spent in it, that it brings up some real bad memories for many people. And just the sight of a textbook for some people is enough to put people on edge. You know, how many people actually enjoy going back to visit their school that they grew up and went to? Like, very few. How many people enjoy bumping into their childhood teachers if they were ever to? Like, yeah, it's even seeing old pictures of you in the school uniform, and, you know, there's so much baggage. So if you're not in the right mindset, you could never expect the kid to be in the right mindset. So deschooling or unschooling as a parent, and understanding that your child is not going to learn the same way that you learned. They're not going to be as proficient in some areas of their learning as you were. Some kids, I've had so many experiences with different families talking about this. You know, some kids, they're like, they don't want to read until like they're 11 years old, and then they'll pick up a couple of books and they're done. It's like completed a book 2 to 3 weeks. Some kids hate doing math until they need it for whatever reason to get, they might be playing a computer game or something. It's like, right, shit, I better hurry up and learn how to do this. Many kids learn to write and spell in very, very different ways. And it's, as a parent, it's trying to let that learning take shape and be in and get in the way when you can and when you need to aid the learning, but keep out of the way whilst everything is just trying to come together and click for the kid. And it's so difficult. And we still have many situations, weekly situations, where my wife and I will just start getting a bit of panic and anxiety. It's like, oh crap, we need to be pushing the kids more in this area. Their spelling needs to get better, or their reading needs to get better, or, you know, we should be doing more mathematics with them. Right, let's try and make sure we're doing math with them every day. And we'll have like 3 or 4 weeks of that, and then, you know, perhaps that will ease up again. And it's difficult. So if anyone is thinking about it, certainly take a very, very deep thought into this process. There's lots of resources online. There's lots of books now as well that you can dig into, and loads of blogs, family blogs, and lots of people. The whole community is very open to reaching out and discussing these topics.
Right. When did you come to the Bitcoin rabbit hole?
Right. So 2000, well, the first time I ever heard about it was very, very early, because I was in foreign exchange. Mm. So now all of a sudden there's this new geek money that everybody's kind of like talking about. Like, you know, who the hell do these guys think they are? What do you mean they're going to invent a new currency? That is ridiculous. Right. So that would have been first touch point. Second touch point, or third touch point, would have been the news of Mt. Gox going under. And you're just like, you morons. Like, so this is now dead, right? We can put a pin in this. Like, right. This is completely gone. because this was never going to work in the first place. And I didn't even understand at that point, really, didn't know reading or research into it, didn't understand that Mt. Gox was just an exchange. I thought it was probably the company behind Bitcoin that launched Bitcoin. Mm. I hadn't even realized it was a pseudonymous founder, and it had just been poo-pooed by myself for many years. And in 2014, the back end of 2013, 2014, when I was extracting myself, I'd got to know Grant Williams in Singapore, and he was just launching Real Vision with Raoul. So we were chatting. We would always chat over dinner, like, you know, like since 2008, like, this is just crazy. Like, these markets are just nuts. Where is this going? This doesn't make any sense, anything. And then I remember saying to him, these Real Vision interviews you guys are putting together are unbelievable. Like, the long form I thought was genius. And I just couldn't stop watching them. And at that point, they were only releasing like one or two a week. And, you know, I'd lap them up. As soon as they dropped, it was like, bam, I've got to see this one. And then I asked him, are you finding, like, purposely finding bearish people? He's like, no, it's just, this is crazy. Whoever we speak to is thinking the same way as us, and this doesn't make any sense. But yet the stock markets are still going through the roof. And then I asked him about Bitcoin. On what about this Bitcoin thing? Are you ever going to run any pieces on that? Because it just seems like a whole ridiculous, like, weird, God knows what. I mean, honestly, what is it? And he said, keep an eye out. We're dropping a few videos in a few weeks. And sure enough, on came an interview with Wences Cesares. Then there was Tur de Meester. Then it was Trace Mayer. I was like, Jesus, these aren't idiots. These guys are, these are highly intuitive, intelligent, really well discussed arguments for this technology. And that's when I just started, where else can I learn about it? And I probably started finding Andreas and reading more about Tur, finding other interviews on YouTube, and started following it from then on, and didn't actually buy straight away. That took probably about another 9 months to be fully committed to thinking, you know, I think Satoshi's words, perhaps we'd better get some in case this thing takes off.
Right. This is like, what, 2014, 2015?
Back end of 2015.
Yeah. Do you remember, like, at all, like, maybe what was clicking about it for you at the time? Obviously, you know, your thoughts have probably grown a lot, but was it the tech? Was it payments? Was it sovereignty? Was it this thing could grow in value? Like, what was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was that. It was an investment.
It was an investment, right?
Yeah. It's like, this thing could grow. This thing could really, like, this is... I was looking at it like I would look at a stock investment.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Because that didn't hit me at first. I just thought it was, like, a cool way to transact. I never really thought about acquiring it for future value. And then, you know, because you're in the markets, I don't know exactly what your role is, but, like, are you looking at all things like even gold at this point? Are you looking at metals? Is that an interest of you at this point?
Yes. So at that point, you know, I was looking at, I was following the sage advice of, you know, diversification. So would, and of course, you get circled by so many, I'll use air quotes, financial advisors, in these expat heavy countries. They're like sharks, which is a real shame. And you get caught out. And what's disgusting is you get caught out by these legacy financial firms all the time. And the big names, right? Zurich, Friends, Provident, Aberdeen, God, you know, you name them. And they prey on 20 to 30 year old guys that have got a bit of expendable cash, and you kind of shame you into not understanding fully what you're investing in, but, you know, you really should be doing this. So I got caught up in a few of those, which god damn, they're just so damn annoying when you look at what Bitcoin is now, like total sovereignty over your money. So yeah, you would diversify into, you'd have one set up in dollars, you'd have one set up in sterling, you'd have one set up in gold, you know, buying gold miners, and then you'd have one set up in a precious metals basket. And then that's all wrapped up in an umbrella. And so like you invest through this firm and then they kick that onto another firm. And the whole way down, all they're doing is creaming commission, you know, they're rent seeking fees and admin fees and all of this kind of stuff. So that was a real eye opener when you start understanding that business and how you've been taken advantage of in the years gone by, when all you were trying to do is save for your future. You thought you were doing the right thing. And unfortunately, the bad actors in the space of, they just get so many people that way. It's pretty disgusting. But I would be actively looking at stocks to try and preserve wealth, you know, save and try and outpace inflation. That was the main goal. So when Bitcoin came along, it's like, well, this could be an opportunity to diversify into this as a savings vehicle. Yeah. And then she bites you.
Yeah. When did you really get bitten personally, where it went from maybe an investment to like, you got to learn about this all the time. It's just catching fire.
Mm. Yeah. Number go up will do that to you.
Right.
And, you know, living through number go down does that to you even more, actually.
Mm.
You know, when you sit through the crazy runs, the crazy bull run, and when you sat through 2017 and you're just sitting there, I wonder how many people are going to be sitting there just scratching their heads when we take off again, scratching their heads rather than jumping around and dancing. It's like, how is this still going up? What, you know, how can I have figured this out? And how are we still so early? So I remember 2017, it was going crazy. It was going up and I was just trying to tell as many people about it as possible. And there were very few resources that you could point people towards. There wasn't the plethora of podcasts and a lot of the books hadn't yet hit the shelves. And you know, there were a few articles and whatever else. And Andreas was still obviously doing his piece. So that was where I would point many people towards. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to know. They really didn't want to know. And I was like, well, am I not conveying this well enough? So I guess you kind of, because you care about it so much and you want other people to learn about it so much because you want them to be part of this and you can see how it can change their life and take away a lot of their anxiety, you want to be able to teach them in such a way that you can get it across. So if I always felt perhaps my delivery is off, so I was always looking for different ways to express it. And that's where you just start finding more and more of the articles. And then, of course, when we started unraveling and going into winter, you really buckle down. It's like, no, this thing is not going to die. I know it's not going to die. There's something here. And look at what we've had in this last, like the quality of the content, I would say, in the last 9 months alone, just unbelievable, incredible. And I'm just very, very hopeful that when we start hitting all-time highs again and creeping up through 20, when people come asking, I can now just, right, I can match a podcast to your personality, or I can match an article. I know you don't like podcasts. I know you like reading. I can send you an article that I know you're going to read within the first paragraph is going to get you. Or I can send you a YouTube clip. Or I can send you a meme. You know, some of these memes are unbelievable, and that takes no effort, right? That's a nanosecond for someone to see it and get it. And a lot of this stuff just wasn't around. And again, I've gone ranting on some tangents there.
what do you think you've learned by doing the pod? In terms of, you know, Bitcoin has so many different angles. It could be sovereignty. It could be an investment. It's a store of value. What is maybe something that's like a new area of interest that maybe came up by doing the pod, or, you know, in this intense, I would say, learning experience of doing the pod?
Yeah, that has. So what I guess if we wind back, you know, like, why did I start the pod? And that was another, like, the procrastination around that. I'm sure you felt the same. Right? It's like, should I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I? And why, you know, who's ever going to come on and talk to me? And, you know, what, why would anyone want to listen to what I have to say? And it's like the same thing with a book. The amount of procrastination about the book was just, you know, the thing was almost finished. I almost never printed it because of the self-doubt and whatever else. So with the podcast, it's like, well, what is the downside? There literally is none. It's all upside. Even if it fails and I only do 3 or 4 shows, imagine I get to speak to 3 or 4 of these guys that I'd really love to speak to. And that would be incredible in itself. And you, as you'll surely back me up on, you know, when you learn so much from people when you speak to them. And my education has just gone through the roof. And when you have people, say someone's coming on that's written a book, there's nowhere in the world I'm going to have them on before I've read their book, right? So then that kind of pushes you to read the book. So my reading just went sky high. And thank all my listening. Thank you, Guy Swan. Huge shout out for for Guy and his work. Because now I can drive and go and do all my chores. I'm walking around supermarkets with Guy in my ears, like reading an article from Parker Lewis. And I'm like, this is crazy, like this level of education. So getting the chance to speak to these guys one-to-one and to be able to see their thought process has been really critical to rounding out my conviction about what Bitcoin is going to become and the social implications. I think Alex Svetsky, I had him on the show. He's like, well, you know, I came for the money and stayed for the money. And, you know, that's such a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. When you realize, I just wish we could wave a magic wand over everybody and like you have no idea the mind virus sound money can have on you. Like, that, just to imagine, like, sound money.
Yeah.
And it's staggering. It's truly staggering, the implications of this thing. It's staggering as well, the amount of FUD that we have to face down as a community. And but the fight, we got to fight the good fight.
Yeah. Do you think the kids will just grow up with sound money, or they're going to have to grok it like we do? Maybe. And it sounds like they're not ready yet, you know, some of the younger ones. So when do we introduce them to Bitcoin, and or does it just become a way of life like Venmo or PayPal for us?
Yeah, I think about that actually, and it's, I think we still got decades probably of fiat behavior and systems and cash, whether that becomes like a completely digitized system, most likely. I hope for them, just hearing it spoken about every single day is going to be enough to set them so far ahead of the curve when this thing becomes more widely adopted, and when they move into young adulthood. This is not going to be something that is just going to come up and smack them straight in the face and like, you know, what the hell is this? They know, they'll be able to know that this thing's been around for a while. And yeah, as much as my dad used to piss me off and talking about it all the time, we've got some kind of grounded knowledge in it. They would know Lauren has spoken to almost all of the guests that have been on the show. So, and now Caitlin, now her older sister has started showing interest. She wants to come in and start off the show. And much to Lauren's annoyance, because she feels as though she's being edged out by her older sister. But, you know, just these touch points that I think is going to set them up for the future would be really, really cool. I don't think we need to push much harder than that right now. Just keep it, because like anything, you push anything too hard, people are going to push back or get bored and push away. So they know I disappear a couple of hours a day probably to go and do a podcast or read a book or catch up with someone to do a Bitcoin talk or brainstorm. So that, I think that's good enough for now.
Yeah.
Although I did just offer my middle daughter, I did just offer her. I threw the little Bitcoin book in her lap. She's downstairs doing the usual thing, flicking through, I don't know, Snapchat or something. So the little Bitcoin book, it lands in her lap and she's like, what the hell? Right.
Yeah.
You want to earn $5? Read that book.
Yeah, I like reading Bitcoin Rabbi, aka Michael Karras, the Bitville, A Tale of Good Money, to my kids. I like what you really, I really like what you said about fiat behavior. I think that's a really interesting way of kind of putting it. And, you know, it's very, there's a lot of levity to you mentioning that it's going to be around for a bit. We're not going to punch through that quickly. You know, this has been really awesome. I really, you know, recommend people check out or continue to listen to Once Bitten. I'm sure everyone here has heard it before. It's a fantastic pod. You've been dropping some bombs, like the one with Jeff Booth and Michael Saylor. I'm just listening to it over and over. That one's really great. I love the rapport between the three of you, and I love hearing, I really like hearing Jeff Booth refilter a lot of Michael's ideas and just kind of off-the-cuff commentary, and then how you kind of really steer the conversation along in a very meaningful way, and it's a great chat, as all of them are. So I really appreciate the work you're putting out. I'll leave it to you. Any parting words, or, you know, definitely let people know where they could find you?
And I just want to say thank you. Thank you for doing this. What number are you up to now? What number episode?
We got 22 out. Yeah, 22. So next one will be 23 tomorrow.
Yeah. That's awesome. And yeah. What's the where do you see you taking this? Is this because I got to say you guys are doing a great job. You've come straight out the blocks. You got some amazing guests on.
Yeah,
it's really great work.
I appreciate that. I'm gonna take it as far as we can go. It's been so much fun. Like you said, I've been having these conversations in my head for a long time. Very one sided. I'm ready for these conversations. I'm enjoying them. Like there's no downside. I'm just gonna keep going as long as it's fun. You know, fun for me, yeah. Fun for the guests, and that's all that matters to me. And, you know, best case scenario for me is I'm leaving a legacy for my kids to just kind of hear what I'm thinking about, my questions, my thoughts, my ideas. And maybe everything doesn't get answered, but they'll get an insight into my line of thinking.
I just actually, before we sign off, it's funny. I was just listening to the Jimmy Song episode you did, and I really loved that. And you asked him a question about his kids in the future. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot as well. And I just hope that when it comes time for them to enter the workforce and go and, you know, go and make the difference that they want to make, that I hope that they won't be forced into a position where they've just got to go cap in hand and take the first job that they get offered, right? Like many of us have had to in the past, especially like the millennial generation. You know, they come out of college, and they just go and join a line as long as can be, like around the corner, just to try and get into like Goldman Sachs or, you know, and end up just taking whatever they can. What I hope for all Bitcoiners kids is what we're doing now is giving them a platform to be able to choose the projects that light them on fire, choose the work that light them on fire, and have the knowledge that because of what we've done with Sound Money and with Bitcoin, that they'll be able to go and chase that dream. And we've got their backs, but they'll be able to go and do the work that is really, really meaningful to them. And it will be project to project, right? I don't think they're going to have a 30, 40 year career in any one sector and then leave with a pension, right? This is, work is going to change and things are going to move very, very quickly. A la Jeff Booth, like, you know, the industries are going to change in a blink of an eye. So if they can go and make the difference that they want in the world, fully backed by the knowledge that Bitcoiners, parents around the world have done the hard work now, put in the education that they need to, taken the self-sovereignty route. And I think that's how I want it to pan out for my kids. So I just wanted to throw that one in there because it was a really interesting conversation you had with Jimmy.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and I appreciate that. I balance that all with I just really also want them to bust their ass a little bit and try their hardest. So it's a balance, you know, and we'll see. I'm so excited for it.
Absolutely.
It's the best thing I've ever done and the hardest thing I've ever done, and I get the most out of it, and I just love being with them. So this has been cool. Awesome. I really appreciate this so much, Daniel. I tell everyone, check out Once Bitten. They could find you, I think it's at Daniel Prince it's Princey76 on Twitter, right? And Princey76 on Instagram?
Yeah. Princey1976. I can't believe somebody had already stolen my handle back in 2009 when I first joined Twitter. At Princey1976.
Awesome. Sorry, I messed that up. Princey at 1976. Definitely check it out and the pod. They're so dope. This has been awesome.
Thank you.
Peace. Bitcoin is for the children with Daniel Prince right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, vote with your thumbs and press 5 stars in that app and subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. That's the best way to get the word out so we can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations about Bitcoin. This is said. Peace out.